G'day, Francis here. Now, finding out accurate info about your rights at work and what wages you should be paid can be difficult. So why not give the Australian Union Support Centre a call? It's completely free and confidential, and the Support Centre is completely independent. Their number is 1300 486 466. 1300 486 466.
On the Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rudd.
G'day, everybody. Welcome to On The Job, the podcast all about making your working life better. Hey, Francis here. Now, Sally's supposed to be with me, but because we're Melburnians and we've gone back into lockdown, we weren't able to get together and complete the recording of the podcast as we were planning to. And we are thinking of everybody who's gone back into lockdown in Melbourne and Victoria over the last little while. It's always really difficult. You've been through an extended one last year. We know how trying that was and traumatic for people, particularly thinking of all of those workers, casual and secure workers, who are losing shifts and money and, you know, wondering how they're going to get through. It is really tough. And we're going to talk more about insecure work on the podcast in the next little while. But, you know, we need to get through it, follow the health and the scientific guidelines, wear your mask, keep your distance, don't be a dick, don't go online and complain about how it all could be better, because somewhere in the world, someone's doing it a lot tougher than all of us. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Anyway, the podcast that we were going to talk about together, Sally and I, was a couple of conversations we've had about working from home. Funnily enough, in lockdown, that's what most of us have to do. And it seems that lots of us also want to keep doing it, even when, God willing, inshallah, this bloody pandemic disappears, or at least is under control. So what does that mean for our working lives? And, you know, who's responsible for the legal stuff around work if we're working from home? Who's paying for stuff? And how do we draw those new lines? We're going to talk about that. And also, cities. Usually designed to ferry huge numbers of workers in and out of central business districts or around cities on freeways and are transiting, you know, millions of people a day. What if we all start staying home? What does that mean for the way our cities look and how our cities work? And is that for the long term? We're going to discuss that as well here on The Job, working from home.
This is On The Job with Francis Leach and Sally Rudd.
It is On The Job, the podcast, all about making your working life better. Francis Leach and Sally Rugg with you. Now, Sally, everyone's packed their new school books and pencils, and they've got that new pencil case smell in their nostrils, which I'm sure you're familiar with at your moment.
Yeah, we're really excited about that.
Load up the backpack as well with all your new school books. So while all that's going on, people are returning to work, and it's a different kind of work world that we're going into. We dealt with it last year. But for some people, it might be their preferred option, working from home and not going back to the pre-COVID way of working.
Yeah, it's funny. The anecdote I'm about to tell sounds made up, but it's genuinely not. I was driving with my stepdaughter a couple of days ago, and we were driving through the city, and she was saying, oh, look at all these really big buildings, and we were talking about them. And she said, what happens in those big buildings? And I said, that's where people work. And she was like, what do you mean? So she's five. And I said, well, you know, like I have an office up there and your daddy has an office in the city as well. And, you know, so people would travel in, and you know how mummy and I work at home. Well, you know, sort of explaining this concept. And like, granted, she's five and she spent the last year of her young life with her four parents working in her two homes. But she was just like perplexed and was like, what do you mean? That is a genuine true story, by the way. And yeah, I thought that kind of sets us up nicely for this conversation.
It does indeed, because the world of work has changed so dramatically. And if you are a young person working from home, and that's it, that's normal, that's what you know. So what happens if you're making that transition? If you are somebody who's been working in an office or working in a factory or working at a static place, and suddenly you're working from home, what are the legalities of that? Who's responsible? Who pays? And what do you need to know? Well, Patrick Turner will be able to tell us. He's a principal at Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. And they've been talking about this in recent times, just to make people aware that things have changed. And with that change, people need to be across what they are responsible for and what they're entitled to. Patrick, welcome to the podcast On The Job.
Thanks very much for having me.
It is a strange time in all of this because I'd imagine for a start, the legislation which usually covers work and what your rights and responsibilities are is probably playing catch up. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think our laws were terribly well designed for such a seismic shift in the way that we work at such short notice. There were a lot of temporary changes, though, that were made to workplace laws to try to accommodate the significant shifts that had to be made in the wake of the pandemic. A lot of those have now expired, but it's certainly been interesting to see how the federal government intends to continue to change the way that people work, or is at least going to attempt to change the way people work in light of the COVID pandemic.
What were some of the temporary measures that have since expired?
So probably the one that might have touched the most people were the JobKeeper changes. So very significant right. changes were made to the Fair Work Act to support the JobKeeper scheme. Those changes, including allowing employers powers that were drastically greater than they had previously to direct people to perform different work, to perform no work, to stand down, which employers didn't previously have available to them under awards or enterprise agreements or contracts. In addition to that, there were significant temporary changes to modern awards that covered nearly every facet of every workplace in Australia, which were always introduced, including providing unpaid pandemic leave to a lot of people, but as well as further allowing employers to issue directions to be able to work from home or to work different hours than they normally would, all of which are changes that employers have been seeking for a very, very long time. But I think in the circumstances of pandemic, people saw as potentially warranted during the temporary crisis.
I didn't realise that JobSeeker allowed employers and bosses to direct their staff to take on different duties or different hours of work. Like, how out there could these employers have gone? Like, could a worker be directed to do something completely different? Like, right now, I know you've been a desk jockey, but now you're going to have to come and, you know, do the gardening of the campus or, you know, whatever.
Look, it's not quite as drastic as that. The employer was able to issue JobKeeper enabling directions, which could include people performing different duties. There were limitations around that. There were notice and consultation obligations before you issued a direction like that. And it couldn't be completely outside your wheelhouse. You couldn't be directed to perform a duty that would be unsafe. So if you didn't have a forklift certificate, you couldn't be told, jockey, tomorrow you can be driving a forklift around the warehouse. But the changes are, they were very significant, I think, for a lot of people would have been a significant disruption to the way they might have worked for decades previously.
So the sun sets on some of those, but are there any overhangs there? Are there some industries where those provisions are continuing on, Patrick?
Certainly. So the JobKeeper changes, that they're still in force formally and they will be until March 2021. They're only available to employers that are still accessing JobKeeper or what are called legacy employers. So employers that did access JobKeeper for a period of time. If you're still on JobKeeper, employers have greater powers than the legacy employers. So yes, for some people, they're probably still being impacted by these laws and by those changes.
Can I ask you, finishing holidays, start of February, I'm going back to work. I'm thinking, oh, they want me to come back and work in the office, but really I'm set up at home. Why make the effort to commute an hour each way when I can do everything that I'm going to do in that office in my home at my desk? And, you know, that's 2 hours of my day I can walk the dog or, you know, water the garden. I don't want to go in. Do I have any standing?
That's a great question. And it's a tough one because I think what this really strange period has shown is that people can be just as productive working from home as working from an office. And for a lot of people, that's allowed them to re-engage with their families. It's allowed them to cut the commute time out of their day, regain parts of the day they never had previously. So there's very good reason that a lot of workers are enjoying working from home, and for many, they will want to keep that. Unfortunately, there will be limits to the extent that you could resist a direction to return back to the workplace. It'll depend what's in someone's contract. It'll depend on whether or not their employer is complying with WHS obligations. So if your employer is not providing a safe workplace to return to, it might be that there's some capacity to resist that kind of direction. But on the whole, people will have to comply with the direction to return to work or risk disciplinary action.
Patrick, I'm not a lawyer, which I'm sure you'll be shocked to learn after my next question. So I'm really interested in people who have to work from home but don't want to, right? Like people, perhaps companies who have thought, oh, great, I can save money on, you know, office rentals. So you all have to work from home now. And the sort of philosophical well, not even philosophical, the quite practical reality that that is a cost-shifting exercise, right? Like workers are now having to sort of host the duties of their company in their home. For the record, I really like working from home, but do employers and companies have any responsibility to contribute towards their workers' rents, for instance, or their mortgages?
The cost of electricity.
Yeah. And I think specifically the reason why rent is on my mind is I'm a renter, but also part of a tenancy agreement says that, you know, you pay X amount a month for reasonable enjoyment of the property or whatever the term is, reasonable privacy and pleasure in the property. And I feel like that's at odds with being ordered to work from home. You know, like if you're set up at the kitchen table, the rest of the people in the house don't have that reasonable private pleasure of the home.
Unless they enjoy watching you slave over your laptop. Which
nobody does.
Sorry, Patrick, what's the answer to that question?
That's a fantastic question. And I think a characterization of it as a cost shifting exercise is a very accurate one. It's a serious concern that I have that employees aren't being compensated for the costs that they might have incurred in working from home, in the transition to working from home. And I think there will be some employers who think, well, it's better to have my workforce at home and to have them bear the expenses. I think part of this cost-shifting exercise is that while people might be able to claim parts of that on tax and they might be able to get a little bit of tax back, really that's a false economy. That just means fewer services are being provided because people are paying less tax, but they're not getting compensated by their employer for the costs that are being shifted home to them.
Sorry, and sort of teasing that thread further, that would mean that the cost-shifting sort of transfers from the worker through to the taxpayer. And so the, you know, opportunity cost of the public purse that is propping up companies who don't want to pay for offices anymore.
So either way, ordinary people are propping up profits for a large company. So I think it's very problematic. To your question, I think it is one of the central issues that haven't been properly addressed or really been a focus of the public conversation is whether employees are being adequately compensated for the costs that they're incurring while working from home. That issue you raise about whether or not employees should be contributing to mortgages or rents is a bit of a novel one. But it's one that perhaps people need to be turning their mind to if this is going to be the future of work.
And what about health and safety issues? If you're in a workplace then and you get hurt, then there's a whole raft of legislation and processes that will protect you and provide you with the ability to have rehabilitation, to be paid while you're unable to work. And that system is very robust. But what is your status if you get hurt working at home?
Well, that's a really good question again, because work health and safety legislation is overwhelmingly focused on safety in the workplace, which conventionally and traditionally, has been considered to be the factory floor or the office that people work in. But there is, I think, sound arguments that employers could be held responsible for injuries that occur in the workplace where people are performing work at home, where they're being directed to work from home and where the employer has a degree of control over the work that they're performing. Another emerging issue is the surveillance of people at work. So if employees are being observed while they're working, if their every movement is being monitored while they're working from home, then I think there's sound arguments to say that employers should be held responsible if someone gets injured while they're there. That's why, you know, it's important, for example, that ergonomic assessments are being conducted for people's home offices and things like that.
Absolutely. So for the first sort of 4 months of my time working at home, I had just a plain old garden variety kitchen chair, which I started to realise after a while was not doing my back any favours. And I eventually bought myself an ergonomic chair. But it's one of those things, Sally, that it might seem inconsequential, but it can really start to have an impact on you.
Yeah, I thought those ergonomic chairs were kind of a scam. But now that I've also been sitting on a sort of dining chair, I'm now thinking I might be wrong there. And Patrick, there was a really interesting, you'll have to help me out with this, I think. There was an interesting ruling last year, if I remember correctly, where a woman was killed by her partner while she was at home, tragically. It was taken to court, and the court in question ruled that it was a workplace incident because this woman was directed to work from home and her employer hadn't provided enough opportunities for safety for her. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
I recall the case, just some of the details that you've reiterated there, but I haven't read it recently.
Right. Sorry, I've put you on the spot. I'll get back to that and report to the listeners what I'm referring
to. But it's an interesting point you raise. The home working environment does throw up areas of serious concern that different parts of the law, Patrick, have to deal with. It will continue to challenge the law and people's status as whether they're at home or at work in ways that we haven't even envisaged yet.
Absolutely. And Well, I certainly hope it augurs a shift in how we think about work and what work's going to look like into the future. I hope it will mean true flexibility for people and greater work-life balance. I'm concerned, though, that what we're hearing out of the federal government and what employers seem to be calling for is flexibility in that old use of the term, meaning keeping wages low, ensuring that conditions are eroded and that people are working greater hours than they were previously.
Can I ask you one more question about something that is going to be the next challenge here, and that is the vaccine? So can your employer or will your employer be able to say that you must be vaccinated before you can come back to work?
Again, that's an excellent question, and that's a hot button issue at the moment.
A lot of praise from you, Patrick. I feel like every time we ask a question, you affirm that it's a good question, and I really like that.
I'm in a very combative profession, so if I get an opportunity to be conciliatory, then I'm going to take it. It is a hot button issue. It's one there's been a couple of decisions from the Fair Work Commission about recently. Both of those cases won't give anti-vaxxers much hope. In terms of the legal position, so employees are required to comply with reasonable and lawful directions from their employers. The key words there are obviously reasonable and lawful, and there's been reams of paper that have been spent on trying to catch what is reasonable and lawful, subject again to what is in someone's contract, subject to the industry they work in, subject to whether or not they might work with vulnerable people, people who are acutely vulnerable to the virus. Then a direction for someone to be vaccinated before they can enter a workplace might be a reasonable and lawful direction. And that's informed by the workplace health and safety obligations on employers that they owe to other staff members there, but also to potentially to clients and customers and anyone who's coming into the workplace. The two Fair Work Commission decisions seem to be indicating that for people working with vulnerable people, so in childcare, the most recent decision concerns a childcare worker, that such a direction might be lawful. We don't have a binding decision on that from the Fair Work Commission at the moment, but I suspect that's the direction the Commission's going to take. Obviously, in an ideal world, you have full take-up of the virus and it doesn't become something that's sheeted home to employers and workers to try to work out.
Patrick, good to talk to you. Just to finish, are you a man that prefers working at home or in the office?
It's interesting. I actually prefer working in the office. I think I missed the interactions with my colleagues, but it might just be more, I think, a bit of a return to normality has made me happier, I think, after those difficult weeks and months that people spent in lockdown. Having said that, I'm working from home more than I ever have, and our team's been working from home more than we ever have. So, I hope other workplaces embrace that as well, because I think it just means better working lives for everyone.
Patrick, thanks for being on the job.
Thanks so much.
Patrick Turner there, principal at Maurice Blackburn Lawyers, talking to us about the pitfalls and all the potholes when it comes to working from home and your rights and responsibilities in terms of what your legal standing is, Sally.
Now, I've got two sort of closing thoughts. Would you like to hear them?
I would.
The first is the one on vaccinations. And I'm extremely pro-vaccination, right? Like I quite literally mainline it to my veins. But I think it's interesting to consider vaccinations as a workplace issue and, whether that is the right way to go. I think that's really interesting. And the second one is I've got the case that I put poor Patrick on the spot for, which was in New South Wales and the Supreme Court ruled that there was workers' compensation nominal insurer v. Hill 2020 ruled that this woman's employer was liable for her death. And this was just last year in New South Wales.
So all that case law is going to start to build up over time and we'll get a much more sophisticated picture of what your rights and responsibilities are when it comes to working from home. It's On The Job, the podcast all about making your working life better. Back with more after this. And we're back. Welcome to On The Job, the podcast, all about making your working life better. Sally Rugg, we were just talking before about how the legal potholes around working from home are just starting to materialise on the highway ahead. And speaking of highways, what about getting to and from work, which is going to change dramatically as well as people, either decide to stay at home or work locally or, are thinking, I'm not getting on that train, tram or bus with all this disease running around.
What a segue, Francis. Wait, I'm going to do one. 2020 was hard, but it feels like we've got another hard road ahead of us.
Boom.
Here to talk to us about roads, it, like, am I doing it right?
You're doing it just fine. He's Deputy CEO of Infrastructure Victoria, Jonathan Spear, because Jonathan's team have been talking about this particular issue and the challenges that it presents. Hi, Jonathan, how are you going?
Hi, Francis. Hi, Sally. You guys are obviously auditioning for the comedy festival when it gets back on.
Would you come? What did you think?
I'll see if I'm available that night.
He's washing his hair.
Yeah.
It's an interesting topic, though. You guys have been doing this work at Infrastructure Victoria, Jonathan. And are we already seeing patterns develop about who is getting on transport, public transport, or who's using the roads and how that's shifted?
Yeah, we sure are. So Department of Transport data is showing that our vehicle traffic on the roads in Melbourne is back to about 89% of pre-COVID levels, whereas public transport usage is still down at around 39%. So we're looking at having much worse congestion potentially while we're not really using the public transport system as much as we did before. And we should have confidence in public transport so long as we're all following the health guidance and, you know, wear the masks and socially distance. And our work shows that there is ample ability to socially distance on, you know, nearly all of the public transport services. But if we don't act now to be managing when we're on the roads and when we're on public transport and how we do that, our modelling shows that congestion could reduce the average vehicle speed down to about 21 k's an hour in inner Melbourne. And, you know, we can cycle faster than that.
And that will be across all cities then, won't it? That's the sort of pattern that will develop across every major capital city in Australia if this pattern is one that sets in because of the pandemic.
Well, that's right. And so what we did in our modelling is we actually looked at other cities in Australia like Perth and Brisbane and Sydney and Auckland too, and as they come out of lockdowns, what the pattern of behaviour was. And what we found was that you had a rebound and an increase in car usage and a decrease in public transport use. And so as Melbourne heads into the new year and we're getting back to work and other activities, we are on that path of more driving and less public transport use. And that's not really setting us up for a better new normal. That's setting us up to have much worse congestion and to be underutilising, you know, our great public transport system.
Those numbers are not good. When you said people on the road are back up at like 89% of what it was before, I thought, oh, I guess people are a little more busy now. But the fact that they're driving and not on public transport is not good. Now, I took a tram a couple of days ago, and like, once I say this, because I know there's so many people who listen to this podcast, once I say this, it's gonna spoil this wonderful experience. But there was barely any people on the tram, and it was heaven. It was so nice. I got to sort of like stretch out and listen to my music really loudly. I mean, it was heaven for me, not heaven for like the future of our communities, but I did like it. But not a lot of people on public transport at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. And we can be confident in getting back on public transport, and we need to, because we need to be setting ourselves up for how we work and how we travel now the way we want to be in the future. And the big thing that we found in our work and our modelling is there is an opportunity to have the best of some of those things that you're describing, Sally, about, you know, not being crowded, having reliable journey times, and also having some flexibility of work. And so if some of us remain working from home across the week, staggered across the week, and if we're not all seeking to travel at the same time, then that staggering really does allow us to deal with this problem of congestion on the roads being worse than it was before, and allows us to make the best use of our public transport system while still socially distancing. And so that's one of the big opportunities we've got right now. And this isn't all just about government. This is about employers and employees getting together now and having this conversation, because we're setting ourselves up. We're all talking about, oh, gee, you know, how many days a week am I going to work, and how much am I going to work from home, and when am I going to get there? And this flexibility is really great for many people. And it can also benefit the way we travel and have a better transport system and a better lifestyle for us. And our research shows that, you know, not everyone can work from home, but about 40% of jobs can. They're really quite well suited to. And if some of those people are working from home for some of the week, and we're thinking about not all arriving on the same tram, jammed to the eyeballs, listening to your loud music coming out of your headphones, Sally, you know, but we're actually staggering that across the day, we're all going to be better off. So the time is now, and it's a big opportunity for employers and employees to be getting together and having this conversation.
Yeah, I guess the incentivizing of that particular behavior is going to be crucial to make it worthwhile for everybody and to dangle a carrot, I guess, for people to allow their employees to shift their time in terms of their commutes and their work time, and then providing the infrastructure that will allow them to do it. So, for instance, off-peak train travel fare and those sorts of things to facilitate that. That's that coordination is going to be key, isn't it, Jonathan?
Yeah, look, we're very much of that view that one of the things that is going to help here is to have off-peak public transport fares that are cheaper. And it's really great to see the Victorian government has introduced that as a trial. It's just starting actually at the end of this month. And I know other cities are doing similar things. And so we think that having a really clear difference in price on an off-peak is one of the incentives to make people think about this and prompt them to have these conversations. And when they think about, well, do I want to maybe leave a bit later because I can, then you do. And what that means is for those who don't have the choice, they're better off too, because they don't have as many people they're competing with for road space or space when they're trying to socially distance on public transport. So everybody benefits. And so we think about those sort of incentives, and we just think about all of the benefits that many of us have enjoyed. You know, last year was pretty tough for many of us in terms of the changes, but there's some good stuff. So now is the time where that flexibility, we can keep that and maybe save some of our travel costs at the same time.
Can I ask you about congestion? So this is a long-term issue in terms of changing people's work behaviour, but what levers are left to city planners and for people who make these decisions to try to mitigate congestion? You know, London, for instance, used the congestion charge to try to keep traffic out of the centre of that city, and that's worked to some extent. Are there other levers you can pull to try to drop traffic congestion and encourage people to get out of their cars and get to work differently if that's where they're going?
Yeah, there certainly are. So look, you can't build your way out of congestion. No city can do that. And cities like Melbourne and Sydney and others, that we are investing in additional road and rail infrastructure, which is really good to meet the growth, right? But it's never going to eliminate congestion, because we know that the more of that you give people, then the more they use it. So it's a balance here about building new infrastructure as well as giving signals to people, like having different prices that are cheaper when you travel off peak, maybe having prices that are higher to drive into CBDs when it's peak period, which of course cities around the world like London and Stockholm have done. But it's not all about building stuff and having to pay to travel in peak period. We've now shown to ourselves over the last year that we can behave differently. And that's why we've got this opportunity right now to be staggering the times and the days that we're working. The other thing we found in looking at Melbourne's situation is that we've identified about 265,000 cycling and walking trips that could be done every day that would otherwise be on the roads or be on public transport. So fairly short trips that people are taking. And instead of driving or taking the public transport, we know that if we deliver, in particular, safe, separated bicycling lanes, that gets people back on their bikes. There's lots of evidence about that. There's this range of things that we can be doing. You know, some of it is about building new infrastructure. Some of it is about the way we price when and how we travel. And some of it is just being smart about using the flexibility that we've all started to experience in the last year to stagger the demand we put on the transport system.
So I'm from Perth. I grew up in Perth, and I remember that a massive change that the government over there made to the rail system in Perth was just thinking about you saying, you know, we can't build our way out of congestion. And you're the expert, so I will defer to your authority on that. But I was just thinking about things that could be built or have been built to sort of help with congestion. And a thing they did in Perth was they built a bunch of car parks next to train stations. So people who lived sort of in the outer suburbs, like if you go down the Mandurah line, you know, train trips that's sort of like an hour into the city or 40 minutes into the city, they build these car parks so to get people off the freeways, acknowledging that like it was quite difficult for people to actually get to the train line. Is that sort of infrastructure workable in Victoria or in Melbourne?
Well, in Melbourne's context, we think that we should probably go one better. So certainly there are car parks being built in some of the outer suburbs. The thing we find is they fill up really fast. So actually what we think is that an even better solution or a good supplement to that solution is for there to be much higher frequency and reliable bus services and for those bus services to be really cheap. Because the bus services in Melbourne are underutilised. There's a number of reasons for that, and some of it's about timetabling and reliability, but part of it's about price. And so we think a combination of much cheaper bus fares all the time and making sure that there's good bus connections from stations to where people live is a really good way to do it. And it gives people a better opportunity to save money, but also they can get better service direct to the station, and that probably actually ends up costing the public purse less as well.
And, of course, as we're saying, that particular experience can be mirrored across all cities, not just Melbourne, in terms of what we learn from trying to increase
That's
capacity.
Right.
Jonathan, I know you're busy. We're going to let you go in a sec, but can you just tell me, just to finalise, in terms of cities changing, are we now seriously going to have to look at mini cities within cities so that we work locally, live locally and move locally and we're not spoking in and out of CBDs? Is that part of the planning that we need to look at as congestion busting to try and make work-life balance better? Is that possible?
It's actually a bit of both, Francis. So CBDs like Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, for example, have got unique things that they offer us. They've got existing really high quality transport connections, especially public transport. They've got great cultural and dining and great opportunities for people to get together and collaborate for those moments that matter, when we do actually need to be together in the workplace, for example, to collaborate really well. So they'll remain important, but we've got the other opportunity for us to take the best advantages of living locally too. Yeah. And so now is the time that we can have a bit of both. And so the importance of local infrastructure like good pathways and cycleways and parks for around our area and to get to the stations, a little bit like what Sally was saying before, is important. And so we can get that benefit to our lifestyle, and we can still be quite productive, many of us as well, and get more time with our friends and family and help our local economies. But it's not an either or choice. It's a bit of a balance between living in the suburbs or even regional cities and the role of the CBDs still being important but being different to how it was before.
Thank you, Jonathan Speer. Great to talk to you. I always like to do a bit of future city planning and talking about that stuff. And when all else fails, my hoverboard that I've been working on for years, I'll unveil at some point, and we can all just surf around in the sky.
Keep an eye out for it, Francis.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan Speer there. Thank you very much. He's Deputy CEO of Infrastructure Victoria. Sally, talking to us there about the challenges of commuting to and from work in the COVID era, which we're all starting to consider as people decide whether they are or aren't going to go back to work and whether it's going to be on the tram with you on the number 86 with your boombox there. What would you throw in the cassette deck if you really wanted to annoy people on the number 86 tram down High Street from, you know, up northern suburbs? Just, you know, the throw in the cassette deck and play loud at the back of the tram.
Well, it's not that I would want to annoy people, but I can imagine, well, I like, you know, I think my taste in music would just generally annoy people. I'd be like, hey guys, you ever heard of a band called Savage Garden?
That'll clear the tram,
really,
especially in hipster, as you went through hipster North, kids. They'll be fleeing the tram like rats from a sinking ship.
I love Savage Garden. I think they're really great. And do you know who else loves Savage Garden?
No, please tell me.
Tony Abbott. It's his favourite band, apparently.
I'm throbbing my mouth.
It's his favourite. I was shocked to find out. It's his favourite.
You're shocked that he likes Savage Gardens.
I know.
Yeah, that's a career killer for Savage Garden.
He's got good music taste, Tony Abbott. I'll give him that.
All right, we're pulling stumps up on this show today. It is On The Job, the podcast all about making your working life better, not improving your musical taste, though. We cannot promise that. Sally Rugg, thank you very much. We can find you on the Twitterverse and everywhere at Sally Rugg.
Yeah, but if anybody wanted to be nice to me on Twitter, that would be great. I've had a whole bunch of people shouting at me for the last couple of weeks. I feel like sometimes I just sort of like fall down the wrong pockets of Twitter and people are sort of shouting at me.
Give Sally a Twitter cuddle. It's not hard. And me at St. Frankly. And you can give us a review on iTunes or whatever platform so other people can find this podcast. Share it with your friends. And we will catch you on the next edition On The Job.
Talk soon.
On the job.